time to open up the vault of history and allow Felix Bonnell to emerge. Trout fishing season opens up on Washington's Lowland Lakes this Saturday, and so our resident historian went fishing around his bookshelf for a prized catch, a mostly forgotten encyclopedia of Washington lakes, first published more than 60 years ago. I'm holding it in my hand.
Isn't that cool?
Right.
Isn't that
now.
It's one of those books, the heft of it is very cool, and that sort of that green leatherette cover with the gold embossed states.
Just the sheer amount of data and diagrams and pictures.
It is.
Overwhelming.
It's very edifying. Now, this is a two-volume set of books published by the state of Washington by an agency no longer around called the Department of Conservation. The books are called Lakes of Washington. Not exactly Bridges of Madison County, but bear with me here. There's one volume for the west side, one for the east. Ton of aerial photos, lots of maps, vital statistics, or something like 8,000 lakes, location, acreage, brief description. Now, I've had a set of Lakes of Washington for years, and I'll admit I only looked at it a few times, but I always wondered how it came about, and I finally read the author's preface and did some digging in the newspaper archives to learn that Ernest Wolcott spent about 40 years as a civilian gathering information about Washington lakes because he loved to fish. And then he got hired by the state in the 1950s to translate all he'd compiled into these books. Now, Wolcott had a pretty amazing 20th century life, born in Kansas in the 1890s, came to Washington as a teenager. He was a maritime radio operator, was actually aboard the passenger liner the Governor when it sank off of Port Townsend in 1921. He was way ahead of his time. He organized civilian emergency preparedness in the 1930s in Seattle by creating a network of ham radio operators. He had his own radio shop here. Served in the Navy during World War II, retired as a captain in the Naval Reserves, and passed away in 1977 at age 78. Now, I was curious if anyone at the state still had these books or knew about them. I found one guy at Fish and Wildlife who had bought copies on eBay. I also found Will Hobbs, a senior environmental scientist for the Department of Ecology. He knows Lakes of Washington, you know, the actual lakes themselves, and these books because he inherited copies on the shelves of his office when he went to work for the state 10 years ago.
They're pretty pristine, like they've sat on shelves for quite a while. But they've got sort of, you know, there's definitely some wear on the spine. There's usually, you know, a name crossed out, somebody else's name, like this one I'm reading, it's Case Siders. Crossed out is James Heckman. So it's passed through, you know, at least three people's hands.
You know, Will says he doesn't consult Lakes of Washington on a regular basis, but he does thumb through them occasionally. He says the content is still relevant, particularly the specialized maps, which help scientists like him figure out where to drill core samples.
The material that's contained within them, you know, is certainly still in use within our agency and within other agencies too. And in particular, the maps that are compiled, the bathymetric maps, the depth profiles of the lakes, are particularly useful.
You know, he used that word bathymetry or bathymetric map, and I asked Will to explain what that is.
It's like an upside-down topographic map, right? It tells you where the sort of deep part to the lake is and where the shallow parts. And in the old maps that are contained in these books, it's all usually in 10-foot contours. So it gives you a great sense of the shape of the basin underlying the water surface.
You know, and he's right. Lake Langlois is a place near Carnation. I used to fish with my dad like 40 years ago. And sure enough, right there on page 170, there's a bathymetric map of Lake Langlois. I had no idea that the lake actually goes down to deeper than 95 feet. It's kind of terrifying. You're sitting on that little lake, you think it's maybe 10 feet deep, but it actually goes down very deep. And Will says the field surveys that he had to do to collect that data back in the late 40s were very laborious. Guys literally going back and forth across the lake many, many times, lowering down a weighted line and then measuring how much line had been fed out to create these incredible profiles. Very analog. Now, Will's a scientist focused on the microscopic world, but he also clearly appreciates the scope and scale of what author Ernie Wolcott accomplished with these books. Now, the data is interesting, but I asked Will if Lakes of Washington gives him any sense of what Ernie was like as a person.
My first impression was that Ernie was a particularly meticulous personality. I mean, you know, you don't compile something like this unless you're really interested in the details of a lot of things. And that's, you know, that would be my first impression. To keep it going, too, I would think that he's probably a stubborn person, too. I mean, wouldn't...
In a good way.
In a good way. Yeah, maybe I should change that. We'll call it dedication. That's dedication to the work, really.
You know, and tracking down family members of Ernie Wolcott was tricky. He does not appear to have any living direct descendants. Thanks to our friend Lee Corbin, who always helps out with research on the show, and who's actually sitting in with us this morning, I was able to talk to a woman from Hillsboro, Oregon, whose grandfather was Ernie's brother, so he was her great uncle. He died before she was born, and her grandfather and Ernie had not remained close later in life. Her grandfather passed away decades ago, and her father passed away in 2016. It's kind of interesting because the existence of Lakes of Washington came as news to Shannon Wolcott Clough, and it made her feel pretty good to find out more about Great Uncle Ernie.
When my dad died, I kind of had that moment of being like, oh my gosh, I'm the last of the lineage, and you know, what is there to really show for it? You know, and kind of had these moments of being like, I'm proud of my dad, I'm proud of my grandfather, but like, who's going to know us, you know, and just to hear that we have a family member. And I've heard of Uncle Ernie before, but I just didn't realize that he did all this amazing stuff and wrote books. And I mean, that's incredible to hear. And if my dad were around, he would be tickled pink. He would be so happy to hear this.
Yeah, it was gratifying to talk with Shannon. I'm sending her copies of all the newspaper clippings and other stuff that Lee and I found about her great uncle. And it's also pretty cool that a modern day scientist like Will Hobbs appreciates Ernie and Lakes of Washington, too. Will said the US EPA does a national survey of lakes every 5 years. It's pretty broad, though, and it's rare to have as grand an effort like what Ernie Wolcott did more than 60 years ago. So I asked him if that spirit of Ernie, you know, the meticulousness, the stubbornness, the dedication, is something worth resurrecting in 2024.
I think so. Yeah. We all need to harness our inner Wolcott.
So, again, I'd love to see Lakes of Washington elevated to cult status, you know, something like Bridges of Madison County. Maybe the movie rights could get optioned, and you could sort of do this sort of
I see Green Lake's only about 20 feet deep.
Isn't that crazy? Yeah. And the contours are fascinating, because you sit on a lake, and it's all flat and smooth. You don't really, obviously you realize
it's the nature of water.
Yes, but anyway, it's
my
amazing.
My question is, according to the prefaces, there's 3,813 lakes and reservoirs in Washington, so why is waterfront property so expensive?
Yeah, well, some of these, when you say lake, sometimes it's just like a little 5 foot deep kind of a muddy pond, right? That's different from being on Puget Sound or Lake Washington. So
anyway,
it's a classic. Lakes of Washington, if you want to find a copy, look online. They're hard to find. They're getting more expensive by the moment since we brought so much attention to them.
Absolutely. I'm intimidated just even to be touching it. Felix Bunnell, all his features at mynorthwest.com. Let's get the Gaza update now. I talked with CBS's Robert Berger, who is in Jerusalem, to ask him about Israel's threat to invade Rafah on the Egyptian border. Where does that stand?
Looks like the Israelis are going to go ahead and conduct this major operation in Rafah. This despite U.S. opposition, because you have more than a million displaced Palestinians taking refuge there, and the U.S. has been extremely concerned about another round of killings of civilians. But the hostage talks have basically gone nowhere. And so Israel feels that it needs to step up the military pressure on Hamas and wipe out the last four battalions of Hamas that are in this town called Rafah, which is on the border with Egypt. So right now we're not seeing preparations. It's the week-long Passover holiday. But I think according to what we're hearing from many sources, it's possible that this operation will start in the next few days.
You say the last four battalions. So is it fair to say this would be the end game finally?
Well, if you listen to Prime Minister Netanyahu, he says that there can't be complete victory without an invasion of Rafah, because what's happened is that most of the battalions of Hamas in northern Gaza in the center have been wiped out during this six-month war, but a lot of the fighters and apparently the hostages have gone to this far south area of Gaza, and they're hiding out in underground tunnels. And according to Netanyahu, that is the way to victory. Others are more skeptical about whether that's true. But the feeling is, it seems, in the military and in the political echelon, that you have to wipe out these last four battalions before you can move toward an end to the war.
I think it's pretty clear that Netanyahu is determined to get this done. He knows that if he stops now, the chance of, you know, restarting the fight would be slim and none. What is his popular support like now in Israel? I have to think most Israelis would love to know that they were living without Hamas's continuous attacks.
Right. So those are kind of two different things. Netanyahu is not popular. A lot of people blame him. This Hamas terrorist attack on October 7th that killed 1,200 people in Israel, it happened on his watch. And there's a feeling that when the war is over, there's going to be a lot of pressure on him to step down, even though he himself has still not taken responsibility for that security disaster. He's tried to throw it on the military and on the security services and so on. Having said that, Israelis do, they're still behind the war because the feeling is if you don't wipe out Hamas, then Israelis in southern Israel are simply not going to be able to live there. So there's still support for the war, but Netanyahu himself is very unpopular.
Yeah. Well, I get that. But what you're also saying is there really is no faction in Israel that thinks you can have peace and still have a remnant of Hamas survive at the same time.
Right. The feeling after that huge terrorist attack on October 7th, the feeling among Israelis is, yeah, you Hamas has to be defeated and destroyed. Now, having said that, a lot of people and analysts feel they don't even know if that's something that can be achieved. Certainly the government is saying it can. The army is saying it can. But the question is, you know, after the Rafah operation, if it happens, Hamas, you know, will still probably try and have some kind of a hold on Gaza. And it remains to be seen if they can be completely wiped out.
Well, is there anybody running for prime minister or in the running for prime minister who is promising I can make Israel secure while allowing the rest of Hamas to survive? I mean, it seems to me anybody you elect to replace Netanyahu would still have to follow up on that commitment to eliminate Hamas, wouldn't they?
Right. Eliminating Hamas will remain a goal. And, you know, what you're likely to see, whatever happens, if the war ever ends, you know, it seems like it's unending. It's already over 6 months. But that Israel will, you know, still have enough security control there to go after Hamas, to go after pockets of Hamas when they know where they are. So as far as his rival, it would be a man named Benny Gantz, a former army chief who's also in the war cabinet. But, you know, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves looking to the next election. And even though Israelis support an early election, most people don't support elections during the war.
CBS's Robert Berger in Jerusalem. And the big bill headed to the president's desk includes TikTok. The question is, will TikTok go dark? Let's go to CBS tech contributor Ian Scher. First of all, Ian, explain what the bill requires.
So essentially, TikTok is being told that because their parent company, ByteDance, is based in China, which is considered a foreign adversary of the United States, at least when we think of national security, obviously in terms of trade, a lot of our stuff is made there, that because of that, the United States government is able to say, look, as a national security issue, TikTok could be a threat to our country. And so they can force the company to either sell itself, and they have to do that within about a half a year, a little more, or face being banned from our shores.
Now, what is the evidence that TikTok is sharing Americans' personal information with the Chinese government? Is there any evidence of that?
You have hit on the biggest issue in this whole debate. Even though we have had former President Trump, you remember several years ago, tried to ban TikTok. And now President Biden, who said he would support a bill on this, which is what got Congress really moving, because as we all know, Congress hasn't done much of anything over the last year, but they got this done, is that really part of the part of what's been interesting is that no one has actually shared the information about where the threat from TikTok is. Congress has received classified briefings where they've supposedly been given the case and laid out the details of why TikTok is a danger, but that case has not been made to the public, right? You and me. And so as a result, a lot of people are upset because, you know, essentially the government is saying, look, you have to trust us. It's a national security concern. We're going to take away your TikTok. And that is causing a lot of people to say, well, wait a minute, why is this?
Well, I mean, there's no question but that China uses computer surveillance on people. We know that's how they use facial recognition to decide who gets sent off to the hinterlands and who gets thrown into jail and things like that. I suppose when they essentially have access to the data of the millions of Americans who have shared their name, image, and likeness on TikTok, they could target them in some way. But what you're saying is that nothing like that has actually surfaced in this debate.
Well, again, the American government has not made its case to the public.
Yeah.
And I think that's key, right? I think all of us should leave open the possibility that there is some very big national security issue. And by the way, there are other apps that have exposed national security issues in the past. One of my favorite examples was that there was a very popular workout app that people in the military were using that had a public map of where people were running around in the country. Well, it turned out if you went into some very secretive places on the map, you could see people running around that looked like nuclear silos, right? And suddenly they were exposing the location of some of our biggest secrets. But, you know, they thought they were just taking a run. And so that is, you know, it's very possible that this issue is very real. But again, you know, we're talking about a first of its kind move, taking away a avenue of free expression in this country, right? We've got the First Amendment that says the government cannot abridge the freedom of speech. And so I think part of what people are struggling with is that, yes, maybe this is a national security issue, but giving the power to the government to essentially shut down one of the most impactful avenues of free expression in this country is very jarring.
Well, I mean, TikTok is tremendously profitable as far as I can tell. I would think that Microsoft, for example, would love to buy it. Is there some reason they can't just buy it?
Well, they did try. And the CEO of Microsoft at the end of it said that he joked around, "I'm happy with what I've got," because it became quite a drama. And look, if you had invented TikTok, imagine the government coming to you and saying, "Hey, you got to sell it. You don't have a choice." And of course, you would be upset. And so I think that there is naturally some pushback from the company in China, who, by the way, have insisted that they have not given any Americans information over to the government. There have been a number of hearings on that. You can decide whether you believe them or not. But, you know, in a lot of ways, I think what's a struggle here is that this is a private company.
Yeah.
Yes, it's based in China. And so this idea that they have to sell this company to an American company, or at least a company that is not based in a foreign adversary's country, is a little jarring for them as a company, and also a huge ask because it is a very expensive purchase.
Yeah, well, I mean, but they would become fabulously rich because, as you say, it would go for a lot of money. Is there a compromise here that's possible? Is there a way they could, I don't know, move their servers to some secure facility at Leavenworth, maybe, so that you can make sure that the data isn't being shared?
Well, in fact, again, this came up during a lot of the congressional hearings on this issue. TikTok has already struck an agreement with American companies to store American data on American shores. And that's part of why, again, we get back to this concern about the government has not made its case publicly. Okay, maybe there is a real and abiding threat. I think everyone is open to the possibility of that. The key question is, even though TikTok has attempted to allay a lot of these concerns, the government says, no, it's not enough. And I think that that is part of where you see a lot of the tension here.
Ian Scheer, CBS Tech contributor. Thanks, Ian.
Absolutely.
And your daily dose of kindness is brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. It's the story of a remarkable man in California known as the Toy Man. Here's CBS's David Begnaud.
They know me by my nickname, the Toy Man.
And what do people know you for?
For my 36 years of humanitarian work and serving 59,960 people. And then...
Not that you've counted.
I do that every year.
For 36 years, what he has done in San Diego County, California, has earned him celebrity status. His bounty has been built with his own money.
Do you know how much money you've spent on giving all this away to people?
I never counted how much, but many thousands of dollars.
Tell me, where have you made all this money from that you used to give away?
I invested my money into the stock market.
It's really remarkable, Jeffrey. You've never had kids of your own, right?
No.
Never been married?
No.
You're so dedicated to other people.
There was something that happened to Jeffrey at a very young age that may have made him one of those other people who have needed his love and support.
Jeffrey, I know when you were a child, you were diagnosed with what doctors thought was epilepsy, right?
Yeah.
But turns out you didn't have epilepsy, right? So they gave you the wrong medicine.
Yeah. And then they were telling me that I was mentally retarded.
Did the medication that you were given incorrectly cause a developmental delay?
Yeah, somewhat.
In some way? Yeah.
A local newspaper investigated.
It appears the doctors were wrong. Recent brain imaging tests included.
And in 1998 reported, what happened to Jeffrey may have happened to other children at a military hospital, and they too have to live with impairments.
But you've used that to your advantage in a way, right?
Yeah, that's also what makes me want to help the people.
I agree.
Because of having to go through that in life.
Can I tell you something? It doesn't take a big brain to help people. It takes a big heart.
The entire story is about 6.5 minutes. It's incredible. His mother took care of people during the Great Depression. His father, a military veteran, also a giver. The entire story is, if you just Google CBS The Uplift, that story is there.
7:49, and now a rare second visit from restoring Felix Spinell. Two visits in the same morning.
Is it even rare? I don't know. He kind of sticks around.
Even rarer than that is that he has brought to us some current news.
I don't know about that. Wait, even that? Wait a second, Dave.
About the... usually your headlines are at least 100
here.
Years old.
Yeah, exactly.
But this concerns the endangered Clark Park gazebo in Everett.
Yes. Okay, you might remember we first reported back in February that the Clark Park gazebo, built in 1921, is threatened with demolition because the city of Everett, who owns it, wants to rip it down. In the latest wrinkle from the tortured gazebo department, the Everett Historical Commission voted unanimously last night to indefinitely postpone taking action on the city's request. This is all very complicated. We'll get to that in a moment. Backstory is that the city wants to establish an off-leash dog park at Clark Park, which everyone is in favor of. But they say they must tear the gazebo down to do so. The gazebo has been a magnet for crime and other undesirable behavior, which is driving away regular park users. The city admits that getting rid of the gazebo won't eliminate the problems, but they still insist it must be torn down. It is a bit of a head-scratcher. Now, the Historical Commission's a board of volunteers who are asked to approve or reject changes to landmarks in Everett. The city first asked for approval to tear the gazebo down back in February. The commission then deferred taking action and instead offered a compromise. Pretty simple and seems to make sense. Compromise is that it was suggested by Historical Commission Chair Patrick Hall. You know, go ahead, build the off-leash dog area and see if it does what's called activating the park. Make it busier with positive things, right? Leave the gazebo there in place for a year or two and see if all those dogs and dog owners coming to the park at all hours will help displace the unwanted stuff at the park and make the whole place come alive again. The dog people get their park, the history people keep their gazebo. A win-win, I think, is what they call that. But the city of Everett, mainly through Parks and Facilities Director Bob Leonard and through spokesperson Simone Tarver, has made it clear they don't want to compromise. They want to tear down the gazebo. They did offer to install some interpretive panels with photos of it to pay tribute to it and to use the look and feel of it to help suggest the design of the dog park. But the commission wants nothing of the sort. At last night's meeting, Patrick Hall, the chair, submitted a long letter as part of the motion to postpone action.
In conclusion, we understand and appreciate that the city is trying to reduce crime and create a healthy environment for its residents under very difficult financial circumstances. We also believe that the best way to achieve these goals is to collaborate with the Historical Commission on possible solutions rather than by trying to simply force your will upon it. The Commission remains willing to entertain less drastic alternatives if and when they are proposed by the city. So that's my motion. Do we hear a second?
Yeah, and it was a unanimous vote in favor of that, so it's pretty complicated. The mayor could just bypass this commission. They're essentially toothless. They're advisors. The city council could get involved. What the supporters of Clark Park Gazebo hope is that Mayor Franklin and the parks director will work with them so they can raise the money. The president of Historic Everett last night said this isn't time to celebrate, but it is a time to sort of take a step back.
Well, I think it's cause for breathing a little bit for some of us. It's a step, you know, to take a breath. And then see what everybody's next steps are. And one of my Historic Everett members walked up to me later and said, let me know when you need some money.
And an email I got very late last night from the city spokesperson essentially said they're going to move forward with tearing it down. Thanks for your help, Historic Commission, but now we're moving forward. So they wouldn't confirm that exactly, but that's what it looks like to me. So lots more drama there at the tortured gazebo department.
Time to tie yourself to a gazebo.
Yeah, let's all go. All of us. We'll get up there.
Everybody, isn't that what they do to trees?
Can I count on you?
Yeah.
Felix Spinell. Thank you, Felix.
Yep.
8:35, Seattle's morning news. Sextortion. Never thought I'd ever hear that word, but I guess it's a real thing. And one company is going to try to stop it. With a report, here's Current News Radio's Mickey Gomez.
We reported last month that online sex crimes against Washington kids is up by 200% from last year. According to Seattle police, it's because children as young as 7 are online. Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, recently added guardrails to protect teen accounts. Spokesperson Lori Moylan tells me they want to prevent salacious pics from being viewed.
The tools that we're introducing will automatically blur those images.
She says a message will appear before a teen can open a suggestive photo.
This image may contain nudity to try to introduce friction before a teen were to open an image that has that.
Friction requires a user to jump through hoops before a possible sexually explicit photo can be seen in hopes that a teen won't open it.
Similarly, if you're going to send something and it detects that there's nudity in the image, it will introduce friction. You know, do you actually want to send this? Every step in this process, they have the power, like the decision-making power, and that engaging with nude images online, whether it's their own or those of their friends, is like obviously not a wise decision.
But that's not all. Moylan says victims of sextortion can take action.
Like the Take It Down tool, which will let you sort of take power over your own if you find out that an image of you is circulating on the internet.
She says Meta is constantly working to protect its users, especially teens.
And just in the second half of last year, we took down 21,000 groups and 37 different networks of people that we thought were engaged in some form of exploitation on the platform.
And
so now if we just suspect that you as an adult account are engaged in a suspicious behavior that may be sextortion, we will start limiting the ways in which you can interact with people that you don't know.
Which means if a flagged user tries to message a teen, Meta won't allow it. Seattle police say it's critical that parents become more involved in their teens' internet use and implement stricter privacy settings because not all platforms are alike. If your child is the victim of a sex scam, do not send money. Save the online interaction and report it immediately to the FBI. Mickey Gomez, Cairo News Radio.
Mickey's with us now. I don't know how this is even a thing.
Yeah.
We're not allowed to broadcast images like this. And it seems to me that if Facebook detects an image like this, it's one strike and you're out. Your account is suspended, all your stuff is erased, and you can't use the platform anymore. It's a private company. It has the power to do that. Why don't they just do that?
Well, what they do block you. They call it Facebook jail or Instagram jail if you do break some of their rules and regulations. They do say, hey, listen, first strike, you're teetering on ending up in Facebook jail.
Yeah.
But what ends up happening is that eventually after 7 days or maybe even 24 hours, you do get your account back. Now, if you are involved in some type of sextortion or you're the person that is
being exploited.
Or you are the exploiter, they will ban your account. But that doesn't prevent you, the exploiter, from being able to get back on Facebook and pretending to be somebody else.
Starting a new account.
That's ridiculous.
Right. This makes me just not want to give my kids social media at all. Mm-hmm. How have you navigated this? Your kids are older than mine.
Yeah.
Especially you have a girl.
Well, here's the thing. She has not been sextorted. The men in our family have. And men are, and this is because Psychology Today says that this is becoming a global crisis for young men. They're becoming more sextorted. I looked it up. They said it's because men are more accepting of online dating relationships. So when somebody does send them a message, it seems real. It seems legit. How I manage this is that I make sure that I'm a part of my kids' platforms. If they're on Instagram,
you get to look at all the DMs.
Look at everything. Okay. I know their passwords. I comment, Mom, stop commenting on my posts, yeah.
You have to get in there.
You have to be involved. And if you are going to allow your child to be on a platform, make sure they're saying their true age. You don't want a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old on Instagram or Facebook or TikTok or Twitter or X, if you will,
saying that they're 21, 25 years old, because then those guardrails don't work.
I see. So when they create the account, fudge their age, and then they
You don't want to do that. Well, yeah.
How a platform can allow a kid on without checking with the parent?
Well, it's been happening since AOL.
I know, but this isn't new. Then shut it down. I don't see why you're allowed to operate. Period. I don't care how much money you lose. Mm-hmm. We're seeing now the consequences are widespread and permanent in many cases.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's not a business model. Just like, you know, you're not allowed to your business model can't be slavery anymore, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if your company involves slavery, we don't let you operate. Same thing.
Yeah. Child labor laws. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's true.
Thank you, Mickey.
You're welcome.
And look who's here from the Generous of the Show. It is G. Scott. You do a lot of flying, don't you?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. You have rights now, it turns out.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, when they screw you over, they have to pay you back.
Yep.
Are you happy with the changes here?
Absolutely. There's a theme. I'm going to have a lot of you all saying it all morning, rest of the day. Give me my money.
Isn't it show me the money?
No. You're not allowed to use Cuba Gooding Jr. anymore.
Is that right?
Yeah, because he's a...
Oh, is he?
You're right.
Oh,
you know, Cuba.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. So, strike that from the record. I take it back. I'll never say it again. Okay.
It is...
Give me the money.
Give me my money. Now, finally, they have come and told airlines, you can no longer just hold on to our money. So, domestically... Anything over 3 hours or more, international, any type of delay,
yeah.
Give me my money. That means that so you get a delay and all this kind of stuff, and then you have to call this airline, and you're on hold for 3 hours and on hold for 4 hours, and then after being on hold, Colleen, the people are like, okay, Colleen, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're just going to give you airline miles. No, give me my money.
But you still have to call? It's not automatic?
Yes. Oh. No.
Oh.
How it was before.
Oh.
Now it's going to be automatic, right?
Oh.
Yes. So whatever means that you paid for the flight, credit card, they have up to 7 business days to give you your money. Mm. Give it back. This is beautiful. Dave, sometimes you're on the phone all this long, and they say, David, I'll tell you what we're going to do for you. You have up until the next year to just be able to fly. We'll give you flight credits. No. Give me my money.
I got to have heard, give me my money.
Yeah, give me my money.
My money.
Yeah, right. Okay. So that's the thing. This is great. Now, I know someone's listening right now, and they know exactly what I'm talking about. You've paid for Wi-Fi. You're on the plane. Wi-Fi doesn't work. And you're at the very end. You're like, what the heck? So you call the airlines, and you're like, yo, the Wi-Fi didn't work. I tell you what we're going to do for you, Colleen. The next time you get on a flight, we will give you a credit for Wi-Fi. No. Today, it is... Give me my money.
What if they don't have the kind of crackers I like for snacks?
I don't know about that, bro. But no, wait. First of all, since we're talking about them snacks, is there anything better than the Biscoff cookies on the plane?
Yeah.
And by
maybe
the
honey roasted peanuts, but I think it's just because they're forbidden now because of peanut allergies really want them.
Yeah. Hey, the Biscoff cookies. So what I did was I found them in the stores. Mm-hmm. And matter of fact, one of my friends gave them to me as a gift, and they gave me the Biscoff cookies. I was like, yes. And so suddenly I go to eat the Biscoff cookies, and I was like, it's not the same. It's not the same eating the Biscoff cookies at home as it is on the plane. And when you're on the plane, you say, excuse me, ma'am, can I have an extra one? And she says, don't tell anyone.
Yes. Have you seen the new Biscoff cookie ice cream sandwich? It's like half Biscoff cookies, ice cream in the middle, then dipped in chocolate.
I've seen it. I haven't had it.
I bet they serve it in first class.
Where did you find that?
Yeah.
I don't know, some online advertisement. And I was like, that might beat the Choco Taco. I don't know. Yeah. That sounds good.
Dave, you fly first class, don't you?
No.
Yes, you do.
No. I did once because the company paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
How was that, Dave?
Huh?
How was it?
Lovely. It was the upper deck of a 747.
Really?
Thai Airways, little flower on the table.
Oh, it was even Thai Airways?
Yeah.
Oh, did you get your own little room? Was that?
No, I've always
wanted to get one of those little rooms you can get on like Virgin Airlines or British Airways. You know what I'm saying? First class?
Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, don't give G a room.
But anyway, that's like $5,000.
Do you wear a tie?
When?
On a plane.
On a plane?
Because back in the day, we used to wear ties, remember?
Yeah. I used to wear ties to work back in the day, but no, not for a long time.
No, okay.
You want some ties, by the way? Because I still got them all.
You know what, Dave? Hmm? I'm going to go ahead and take a pass on your ties.
Yeah.
All right, Dave, I'm going to leave. But what was the theme of the day? What was it?
Give me my money.
There we go.
Did I get it?
Almost. We can get there.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.